Okay, our next presentation is Lisa Doris Alexander, who will be speaking on the court-martial of Jackie Robinson and Hollywood's version of Robinson's legacy.
Alrighty. Thank you. I'm a wee bit shorter than most. So, when Brian Hegelein's 42 was released in 2013, there was a renewed discussion about how Jackie Robinson's image had been portrayed over the years. While most critics enjoyed 42, they felt it had an after-school special feel to it, a sentiment that was echoed by some of my students when I screened the film for them this past March. At the same time, most agreed it was an improvement in almost every way over Alfred Green's 1950s film, The Jackie Robinson Story, which was very much a product of the post-World War II, pre-civil rights movement time in which it was created. A fair amount has been written about the Jackie Robinson story and 42, so today I want to spend some time with the oft-forgotten 1990 made-for-TV film, The Court Martial of Jackie Robinson. And I want to talk about the messages that the film tells about Robinson, baseball, racism, and society as a whole. I am going to take for granted that most, if not all of you, have seen the Jackie Robinson story in 42, even if they're not necessarily fresh in your memory. And if not, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess you all know how Jackie Robinson's life more or less unfolded. If you don't, you need to go read some books right now. So, Court Martial aired on TNT and starred Andre Brower as Jackie Robinson. Many things have changed between 1950, when the Jackie Robinson story was released, and 1990. The Cold War was officially over. Instances of de jure racism and Jim and Jane Crow were less overt. And professional baseball had a multitude of black and brown players. While Jackie Robinson's story primarily focused on individual acts of discrimination, Court Martial moved in a very different direction. The opening credits scroll amid a backdrop of photographs that highlight Jim and Jane Crow. One photograph is of a black man walking past a movie theater that has a colored balcony sign, while another photograph features several white police officers beating and restraining a black man. The final image of the opening credits, which will come up in a second, is the infamous photograph of Tom Shepard and Abram Smith's lynching, an image which provided the inspiration for the poem/song Strange Fruit, sung by Billie Holiday in 1939. Even before a single line of dialogue is spoken, it is clear that The Court Martial of Jackie Robinson will be a more visceral film than the Jackie Robinson story. While self-sufficiency was key to Jackie Robinson's story, the Jackie Robinson in Court Martial continuously relied on outside advice and support. At one point in the film, we see Pittsburgh Courier journalist Wendell Smith, played by J.A. Preston, discussing black players with two baseball scouts. It is clear that Smith knows the scouts, and they know him. And Smith makes it clear that everyone knows that reintegration of professional baseball is coming. The story of baseball's reintegration presented in Court Martial is more in line with actual historical events than either the Jackie Robinson story or 42's version. While Dodgers general manager Branch Rickey signed Robinson, sports writers such as Smith, Sam Lacy, and Lester Rodney had been publicly advocating for the dissolution of baseball's color line for quite some time before Robinson was signed. There had been demonstrations and called for legal action against baseball teams that did not sign black players, and that collective action led then New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia to create a committee on baseball to push the Yankees, Giants, and Dodgers to sign black players. Court Martial advocates the idea that racial progress was not just the result of top-down edicts, but was also the product of bottom-up grassroots agitating. In Court Martial, Robinson turns to Smith when he is court-martialed, and the film shows the journalist writing columns on Robinson's behalf. In his autobiography, I Never Had It Made, Robinson recounts that it was not him who reached out to Smith, but it was, quote, some of my black brother officers who were determined to help me beat the attempted injustice in my case. They wrote letters to the black press. The Pittsburgh Courier, then one of the country's most powerful weeklies, gave the matter important publicity. The Army, sensitive to this kind of spotlight, knew that if I was unfairly treated, it would not be a secret, unquote. Though there is no byline attached, I did find an article from the Pittsburgh Courier dated August 5, 1944, with the headline, Lieutenant Jackie Robinson Faces Court-Martial. It is likely that Smith wrote the piece. In reality, instead of writing to Smith, Robinson actually asked the NAACP for assistance by writing, quote, I feel I am being unfairly punished because I wouldn't be pushed around by the driver of that bus, unquote. Though he did not hear back from the NAACP until the day after the trial began, it is telling that Robinson went outside of military channels for assistance. Again, this film does not embrace the pull yourself up by the bootstraps method of empowerment. Robinson received support from his fellow black soldiers, Smith, and boxer Joe Lewis, who is featured prominently in the film, advising Robinson on how to navigate the Army's racist environment. In the Jackie Robinson story, the black press is never mentioned, and in 42, when Robinson meets Smith, the former acts as though he's never heard of Smith or the Courier, which is both historically inaccurate and insulting, given the importance of black newspapers at the time. In addition to moving from self-sufficiency to collective action, court-martial moved the entire Robinson family from passive characters to people who actively engaged with each other and the world around them. Two characters in particular, Rachel Robinson and Jackie's mother, Mallie Robinson, were significantly more forceful in court-martial than they were in the Jackie Robinson story. When the story was first released in 1950, the second wave of feminism was still roughly 10 years away, and female characters in films were usually not strong protagonists. 40 years later, though the roles were small, both Rachel and Mallie Robinson had significantly changed. Both films include a scene where Robinson contemplates leaving UCLA. In story, Mallie Robinson, played by Louise Beavers, is somber and resigned. Film scholar Donald Bogle described Beavers' portrayal as, quote, moon-faced, still mellow, and marvelously meek, unquote. Robinson questions the utility of a college degree, arguing that his brother, Mac, graduated from college and the only job he could find was as a street sweeper. Mac appeals resigned to his fate and simply states that at least it's a steady job. In court-martial, Robinson's mother, Mallie Robinson, played by Ruby Dee, is livid at the idea that Jackie would leave school. This time it is Mac who reminds everyone that his college degree and his Olympic medal were not enough to secure him a coaching job. Mallie Robinson reads them all the riot act, and the only thing that ends her monologue is a radio newscast announcing the attack on Pearl Harbor. Court-martial also portrays Rachel Robinson as having a more active role. Ruby Dee, who played Rachel Robinson in the Jackie Robinson story, remarked that, quote, the minute I talked with Rachel, I had the feeling I wasn't doing her justice. She was a stronger woman than I had portrayed, unquote. In court-martial, Cassie Lemons plays Rachel as a strong, outgoing woman. In one scene, Rachel informs Jackie that she has joined the Naval Cadet Corps. Jackie does not agree with her decision and demands that she quit. Instead of agreeing to leave the Corps, Rachel returns his ring and promptly ends his engagement. It is clear that Rachel intends to chart her own path with or without Jackie, a fact that Robinson eventually respects. Just as Mallie and Rachel Robinson are more forceful in court-martial than they were in Jackie Robinson's story, Robinson himself undergoes a similar transformation. In story, Robinson's dialogue was minimal, and the basic narrative tended to emphasize the need for passive composure. Court-martial portrays Robinson as more self-assured and confrontational. When a colonel refused to advance his application to officer candidate school, Robinson first requests to go over his head and then enlists Joe Lewis's help to attain his goal. When a white officer defends segregated seating in the commissary during a phone conversation, Robinson meets with the officer in person to express his displeasure with the seating arrangements and to make sure that the officer in question knew that Robinson was a black man. Robinson is framed as a man who knew his rights, he knew military policy, knew segregation was wrong, and actively worked to make things better for the black soldiers under his command. Robinson demanded the respect his humanity and rank deserved, and because of that, he was labeled a troublemaker and shipped to Texas, a move that eventually led to his court-martial. When Robinson refused to move to the back of the bus, a request that Robinson knew was in violation of military policy, he forcefully argued his case, even as the military police continuously referred to him as, quote, that nigger lieutenant. After enduring the barrage of racial epithets, Robinson makes it clear that there will be consequences if the MPs call him out of his name again. At that point, the camera moves into a close-up of Robinson's face that conveys the emotional toll the language has had on him in such a short period of time. But the close-up also conveys a substantial amount of rage. For Hollywood in the 1950s, the primary response for blacks could have to racism was disappointment and resignation. By 1990, black characters were allowed to show anger at being treated like second-class citizens. In addition to displaying more emotive characters, Court Martial gives the audience a slightly better understanding of systemic racism than Story or 42 provided. 42 shows that there was legislation in place that prevented Robinson's integrated teams from playing all-white teams when a sheriff removes him from a playing field during a game. The segregated buses was instigated Robinson's court-martial were not a policy put in place by a single individual. These were company policies and city and or state laws that demanded the separation of the races. Court Martial also makes it clear that the armed forces as an institution was racist and that racism was not only based upon discriminatory acts by individuals, but the racially segregated units and facilities were not solely the prerogative of racist individuals. A coda at the end of the film reassures the audience that the systemic racism illustrated in the film is no longer a problem. While Court Martial acknowledges that systemic racism existed, it presents it only in forms that have been successfully eradicated. Much of this shift can be attributed to the general change in attitudes toward race and racism in the years between Story and Court Martial. However, another possibility may explain what's going on here, as there were increasing discussions about race and racism during the time that this film was being written and produced. In June of 1989, Spike Lee's controversial opus on race relations, Do the Right Thing, opened in theaters and sparked a national conversation on race relations. The film deals with police profiling and brutality, urban ethnic conflicts, the crisis in black families and relationships, and challenges the audience to grapple with the dynamics of race, class, power, mobility, and privilege in ways that few films have done since. The racial conversation was intensified 2 months later when a group of white teenagers attacked and killed 16-year-old Yusef Hawkins in Bensonhurst, New York. Court Martial then can be read not just as a tribute to Jackie Robinson, but as a contribution to the public discussions of racism that were already in progress at the time. And finally, Court Martial shifts the importance of Robinson's legacy away from the baseball diamond. The film ends with Robinson playing for the Kansas City Monarchs and the scout who spoke with Wendell Smith earlier in the film assuring him that the offer to sign him to the Dodgers is not a joke. Aside from some brief clips of Robinson playing baseball, basketball, and football in college, the film actually spends very little time engaging with Robinson as an athlete. Instead, the film chooses to portray him as an outspoken advocate for civil rights. In fact, the film's final coda is presented here and puts Robinson's advocacy of civil rights front and center. The statement highlights the idea that Robinson was a baseball player who was clearly talented enough to earn induction into the Hall of Fame. However, the statement also underscores that Robinson's contributions to society were not limited to his role as a professional athlete. In essence, the importance of Robinson's story, as Jules Teigle asked the critical question, what is it about the Jackie Robinson story that we should not forget? We should not forget that Robinson publicly supported John Carlos and Tommy Smith's 1968 Olympic protest and was the only player, past or present, who testified in support of Curt Flood's lawsuit against Major League Baseball. But you wouldn't know that by watching any of the screen adaptations of Robinson's story. Also missing from the screen versions of Robinson's story are the way that sports writers turned against him when his ban on fighting back was lifted, the fact that Major League Baseball would not employ him after he retired as a player, and the choice words he had about baseball shortly before his passing. Of course, there was nothing regarding his business dealings or his political machinations with Nelson Rockefeller and Richard Nixon. It's safe to say that Robinson not only understood how he influenced the world around him, but equally important, how the world around him impacted his life. 42 in the Jackie Robinson story disregards that Jackie Robinson, while the made-for-TV film, The Court Martial of Jackie Robinson, seems to come the closest to portraying a full picture of Jackie Robinson.
Institutional racism within the film industry itself and de jure segregation within American society as a whole during the 1950s helps explain what's going on with Jackie Robinson's story. At the same time, because the film was made at the beginning of his career, many of the events that he participated in and spoke out for and against had not taken place yet. By the 1990s, a more complete picture of Robinson was available, and given conversations about race and racism at the time, the court-martial of Jackie Robinson could and did expand upon Robinson's life and present a more nuanced account of the kinds of racism Robinson endured and fought against. The post-racial, and I really do hate that phrase, but there it is, ideology and the conservative backlash against President Obama and any discussions of systemic racism informed the safe version of Robinson and racism portrayed in 42. Now, no film can be everything to everyone, and no film can convey the entirety of an individual's life. However, it is incumbent on filmmakers to fully understand the subject they are bringing to the screen. The problem with the Jackie Robinson story and 42 seemed to stem from the erroneous notion that Jackie Robinson's impact on history and culture is primarily due to his status as a ball player. It is certainly true that we know who Robinson was because he helped reintegrate professional baseball, but some filmmakers make the mistake of thinking Robinson's legacy ends there, and that does a huge disservice to the audience and to Robinson himself. Unfortunately, the things we should not forget about Robinson's story have yet to be adequately portrayed in popular film. Thank you.
We do have time for questions, so if anybody wants to line up at either of the microphones.
Thank you. This was great. Can you talk about the availability of the court-martial of Jackie Robinson, where we can find it today, if at all?
I found it through the University of Michigan Library on VHS. It has not been released on DVD. Are we recording this? Hopefully not. I did create an MP4 file of the film. I cannot sell it because I do not want the Justice Department coming after me. But if you have trouble finding it in your local library, because who uses VHS anymore, send me an email.
Hello, Lisa.
Hi.
My name is Mickey DeLip, and I don't know if you know this, but on Broadway, there was a play about Jackie Robinson. Mm-hmm. I think it was called The One?
The First.
The First, okay. The First, it didn't do well. I think it was a musical.
Yeah, it was.
I didn't know it was a musical.
I thought it was because I saw a poster outside of a theater, and I bought it, and I had it for at least 15 to 20 years, and then I gave it away to a student that was a Robinson fan. But I don't know why it didn't do anything.
Get a chance to see the play.
I bet on the internet you could dig it up.
YouTube has everything, except the court-martial of Jackie Robinson.
Lisa, great report. I find it very surprising that the NAACP didn't get involved till after the trial started. It would seem to me this is a perfect type of thing that they, in those days, that they would get involved in.
I think it was bureaucracy, partially that, you know, again, we didn't have the internet, so it might have taken them a while to actually receive the letter and to figure out what they wanted to do about the situation, if anything. Or they thought at that particular time, picking a fight against the Army might not be the best idea. But I'm actually not sure which of those reasons is to blame for why the NAACP did not get involved. But it worked out in the end for Jackie Robinson and not so much for the Army.
How are you? Yes, that play, by the way, it is a musical. I have the playbill for it. But you mentioned that the Pittsburgh Courier, featured a headline that Jackie had been court-martialed. What about the other media? I mean, he was an All-American football player at UCLA. I mean, did he have any mainstream media coverage of that event?
Mainstream coverage, not that I've seen. There were other black newspapers that did talk about it, but in the same vein, because as you pointed out, you know, Jackie Robinson was known to the black press at that time, so they did take a great interest in what was going on with his case.
Okay. Did you go to UMich?
No, I actually went to UCLA as a grad student, so. But teeny tiny college called Grinnell that no one's ever heard of but me.
Well, we have
no,
Grinnell,
no, Grinnell
don't
with
sell
a G.
The place.
Yes, in Iowa. 4 years in the cornfields.
Hi, Lisa. What did the critics say about the court-martial of Jackie Robinson?
I only found one review from TV Guide, and they said it was pretty good. Today, obviously, every news outlet would talk right. about a made-for-TV movie, but at that time, no one really cared. And I think part of that was also due to the fact that Andre Brower, who is more or less a household name now, this was only his second or third role.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a big hoopla over this TV film. He had not done Homicide yet, but he had done Glory. And actually, after he did the court-martial of Jackie Robinson, he did another made-for-TV film called The 10,000 Black Men Named George, which is about A. Philip Randolph and the Pullman Porters, which is excellent. It was done for Showtime. Mm-hmm. And that is on DVD.
So a little closer. It seems to me just that there's one missing element here that's being glossed over, which is that Jackie was discharged from the U.S. Army with the war still in progress. Do you feel that court-martial correctly conveys Jackie's attitude about that, or do you think that it glosses it over?
No, I think because we do see the outcome of the trial in the film, we do see him being discharged, and part of that was the Army more or less just not wanting to deal with Robinson anymore. So we do see that, both that sense of, yes, I've gotten out from under these erroneous charges, but also this kind of disappointment that he was not able to fight overseas with the men that he trained. But you do see a little bit of that.
How do you feel that being discharged feeds into the rest of the story of his life?
I'm not actually sure. I mean, in Rampersand's biography of him, he talks a little bit about it. So I will leave that to the person who's done far more research on that area than I have. But I think from what I have read, there was a general disillusionment with the armed forces after the court-martial incident and other, just his general time in the armed forces, which were not particularly pleasant, to put it mildly. So it was both the Army wanting to separate itself from Robinson and Robinson wanting to be separated from the Army, just not under the looming of a court-martial.
Lisa, great talk. I was just curious, because you were talking about how there were different aspects of his life that really didn't get on screen in 42 in the Jackie Robinson story, and I think that's partially because the movies are kind of snapshots, and it's got the great arc with, oh, he overcame all this adversity and ends at the end of the 1947 season. It's an obvious ending. I was wondering whether, you know, if you could ideally, you know, make a movie about Robinson's life, if you could sort of do that while including the 47 season and sort of everything and getting that, you know, later portion of his life where no one really speaks about it. If that's a question that makes sense. I'm sorry.
Yes, I get it. And a lot of people have said this, and I will reiterate this. I think that if Hollywood had given Spike Lee the money he asked for to do Jackie Robinson's film, which he was working with Rachel Robinson to do, we would have gotten a far different film than we've seen so far, because he really wanted to go the same route he did with Malcolm X, which is also a flawed film, but you do at least get a more complete picture of who Malcolm X was. And I think if Spike Lee had done the film, we would have gotten that. On the other hand, we probably, to say something nice about 42, we might not have gotten the more complete picture of Rachel Robinson that 42 provided, because Spike Lee has not done well by writing his female characters, but he's growing.
Do you think it would have kind of...
He's trying.
Do you think it would have kind of tarnished his reputation a little to sort of show that kind of, you know, outspoken black power attitude that he had later in life?
I don't think so, because I think one of the things, at least for me, that I do admire about Robinson was the fact that he was outspoken. Most of the films kind of portray him, and there's also the white savior issue that's going on in both 42 and the Jackie Robinson story, which I do not think would have been present in a Spike Lee film. But I think we have this tendency in all of our kind of biopics to elevate the people that we're talking about to such a level that we can't attain that. We really need to see these people as human beings, because that tells us that, hey, if this person could fight against these issues and overcomes these odds, then maybe I as an audience member can do that. It's one of the things I really liked about the movie Selma, because Martin Luther King was a human being in that movie. He wasn't this statue. And I think a movie about Jackie Robinson that did that could be pretty awesome.
Hi, I think you just answered my question. I missed the beginning, so I don't know if you had talked about Spike Lee earlier.
I didn't, but...
But I was going to ask you if you had ever talked to Spike Lee about the film, because the late Jules Tigel talked to me about Spike Lee having talked to him about making this film, and I knew the film had kind of died off. In addition to talking about different dimensions of Jackie Robinson, did he tell you anything about, was he going to play up the role of folks like Lester Rodney, which didn't get mentioned at all in 42 or in any earlier Jackie Robinson film?
I have not spoken to Mr. Lee about it. And he doesn't really talk about it in interviews. All he said is that, you know, financing fell through. He's very diplomatic about it, which is unusual for Spike Lee. Rachel Robinson has said on a couple of occasions, A, that she wanted Spike Lee to do it. Actually, she was very specific in saying she really thought that a black man should direct the story about Jackie Robinson, which didn't obviously happen in any of the three cases. But as far as I know, it was just a financing issue. I don't know how far they were on the script. So I do not know if Lester Rodney would have been included.
We have time for one more question.
Lisa, enjoyed your presentation very much. So I'm a little bewildered, because maybe I didn't get the right information, but I had heard that Rachel Robinson did approve of the 42 film. So explain that.
She did, and Rachel Robinson had been trying for decades to get a big screen adaptation of Jackie Robinson's life made, and the only interpretation that I can have is that she realized that this was probably going to be the last shot, and so it was all or nothing. But I have not spoken to her. I've met her once. She's a wonderful woman. She's far more active at 90 years old than I am at 40. That's my general sense of it, and since it was made, she can't really go back and badmouth it. That's what I'm here for.